Sun. Lee Court almost no introduction, and the judge in the court case in which he was on which he was working today let him out early so that he could come here, which I think is a, I don't know, it's a great compliment to Ah Wei Wei or to Art Blackham or to us. Professor Nick Joes, or Nick Joes, we're just going by our titles here to make it more informal, who many of you would know, Nick, many of you don't, but he's really, he has a number of hats. Nick is a writer, as a professor, as an academic, but Penn is, I think, is the link between what we are discussing tonight and Nick's professional life. Even though it's only a small part of his professional life, the link is quite clear. And then the famous, you know, man that we all know, we all read, we all follow, John McDonald. So, clap for Nick and and I am now going to, to talk into this, to pass over to one of our speakers, and perhaps we'll go with Julian first, to ask Julian's thoughts, because he's not particularly coming from an art perspective, on art and activism. What is the link between art and activism? Should there be a link? And if there should be a link, what form he feels it might take? And then perhaps some examples, if possible. And the format will be that we ask each of them to speak for about 10 minutes, and then I will ask one or two questions myself, and then we'll open it up to the floor. Okay, here we are.
Can I start with a question?
Yes, you can.
Do I have to talk about art and activism?
You don't. You can talk about whatever you like.
When I got the wonderful catalogue of Erasure, I started thinking about Erasure and what that exhibition means, but about the thing more broadly. And I thought, well, if I've been invited to Sydney, it's probably not to hear my views about art. And so perhaps it's something to do with refugees, which seem to fit fairly well with Dim's origins. Anyway, well, I think about Erasure because I'm interested in words, and you don't hear Erasure very much. But of course it's about forgetting, perhaps about actively forgetting, perhaps about rubbing things out and putting things out of one's mind. And I thought that's a pretty important theme in Australia at the moment, because although one of our most resonant phrases in Australia is "lest we forget," dedicated to those who fought and died in the First War, the fact is that forgetting is at the heart of our culture. Forgetting is what Australia is all about. Erasure, especially, is what Australia seems to be all about. And we cover it over with the fig leaf of noble sentiments like "lest we forget." Who could overlook, for example, the fact that in recent years we've been obsessed with the so-called illegals, called illegals, not illegal, of course, because they don't break the law by coming to Australia and asking for our help, but we call them illegals, and that's a word, it's an idea which has great traction in the public. How curious, then, that we forget that the true illegals were the convicts who established the country. They were people who'd actually been convicted of criminal offences, and they were thrown into the dust heap of this country, and perhaps as an important symbolic first gesture, they continued their stealing ways by stealing the land from the first people who came here, the only people who, in my opinion, are entitled to express any concern at all about people arriving uninvited in small boats. We also conveniently forget the optimistic phrase in the second verse of our national anthem, that for those who come across the seas, we've boundless plains to share. What an extraordinary thing. We are a curious nation that way, aren't we? How we manage to forget some of the central features of our national character. I mean, how many people actually contradict their own national anthem in what they do every day?
How many people know it?
Yeah, how many people know? And is there a country elsewhere on earth that eats both of the animals on its national crest? Perhaps you have to choose something like a bald eagle, which isn't too tasty anyway.
How do you know?
Well, look, that's a secret part of my life. I thought I'd got past it. And then the Vietnamese. I have a very close connection, obviously, with Tim's work. We know and enjoy Vietnamese food. We've been going to Vietnamese restaurants for 30 years now and thinking that what a wonderful thing. We now have second and third generation Vietnamese who speak with Aussie accents and who, apart from their appearance, are seamlessly part of the Australian landscape. And it's only by their appearance that you might even guess that they didn't, that they weren't of the traditional Anglo stock. But we seem to forget that we scarred their country terribly, along with the Americans. In January this year, I was at the Museum of the American War in Saigon, a very chilling, interesting place, not least because it is so understated, with a couple of broken down American war machines out the front, and the usual predictable collection of small armaments and bullets and things. But then photographs showing the most terrible things, which we all know happened. Photographs, for example, of a cheerful looking GI holding up a trophy, and the trophy is the head and the flayed skin of a child. And what's awful about it is that he seems to be proud of this trophy. There are photographs beyond number of the villages that were destroyed in the search of the Viet Cong, and more photographs than I ever would have imagined of what was done by Agent Orange in that country. We knew about Agent Orange in a vague way. I don't think anyone quite realised the extent of the devastation which Agent Orange caused, and we have forgotten almost entirely what we did to that country. And sadly, we've also forgotten what Malcolm Fraser and Ian McPhee managed to do with a bipartisan policy of resettling swiftly every Vietnamese boat person who could show that they were in fact a refugee. We've forgotten that in those few years in the late 1970s, we resettled about 20,000 Vietnamese boat people each year. And now Tony Abbott gets hysterical. If we get a few hundred boat people coming here, or a few thousand boat people coming here, what is it about our ability to forget? People smugglers. We are very forgetful when it comes to people smugglers. Tony Abbott, when he took control of the opposition, started banging the people smuggler drum. I think he'd worked out, and perhaps it was just one of those dim fragments of his training for the priesthood, which he hasn't forgotten. He noticed, I think, that there was something unrespectable about criticising boat people for trying to escape Saddam Hussein or the Taliban. And so instead of criticising the boat people themselves, he started criticising the people smugglers. And the new refrain was, we've got to smash the people smugglers' business model. what a curious thing. And Kevin Rudd fell into line with him, let's not forget. And of course, Julie Gillard and Chris Bowen have done likewise in more recent times. What a curious thing that we seem to have forgotten that Oscar Schindler was a people smuggler. We overlooked that entirely. We loved the book, we loved the film, we thought he was a great guy, but he was a people smuggler. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Kevin Rudd's hero, was a people smuggler. Captain Schroeder, the captain of the MS St. Louis, which embarked from Hamburg in May of 1939 with 900 Jewish refugees on board. He hawked them all around the world. He pulled every possible trick to find a safe place for them. He was pushed from pillar to post and ended up having to bring them back to Europe, where they disembarked in Antwerp. And when the Low Countries were overtaken by the Nazis, more than half those people died in concentration camps. We seem to have forgotten that Captain Schroeder, hailed as a hero then and as a hero now, he was a people smuggler. He did the whole thing for money. And John Howard, who I'm sure was brought up with The Sound of Music as their favourite musical and then film, he's probably forgotten that the Von Trapps were refugees and the nuns were people smugglers. How is it that we forget these things so conveniently when politics and cheap partisan advantage is to be got by banging the populist drum? We seem to have forgotten the Hazaras in Afghanistan. I have a special place for the Hazaras in my heart. We've had Hazara Afghan asylum seekers, refugees, living with us for nearly a decade now. And they are fine people. We do remember, vaguely, in the corners of our mind, February 2001, when the Taliban blew up the two great Bamiyan Buddhas. What we don't remember is that the Bamiyan Buddhas were carved by the Hazaras soon after they arrived in Afghanistan. They were carved by the Hazaras who were then Buddhist, but who are now Shia Muslims. we forget that the way the Taliban destroyed the Bamiyan Buddhas was by sending, lowering Hazaras on ropes with bombs strapped around their waist and then detonating the bombs whilst they were adjacent to the statues. We tend to overlook, conveniently, that the Hazaras are the subject of ethnic cleansing at the hands of the Taliban. We've completely forgotten the fact that the Taliban were installed by the Americans in order to displace the Russians. How is it that we managed to forget that, and yet at the moment, although 95% of Hazara asylum seekers getting to Australia have been accepted as refugees over the last 15 years, now they are being rejected 90% of the time. It must be that the Taliban have suddenly come to their senses and started behaving well. I must have forgotten that that had happened. And I was thinking just on Monday. Monday was the fourth anniversary of a judgment in a very important case, one which I was privileged to run, for a bloke called Bruce Trevorrow. Bruce was an Aboriginal boy who was born at One Mile Camp out of Meningi in 1956. And when he was 13 months old, on Christmas Day of 1957, he got sick. And his father managed to find someone who had a car who would take him up to the hospital, the Children's Hospital in Adelaide, so he could be looked after. And the hospital notes show that he was admitted on Christmas Day 1957 and was diagnosed with gastroenteritis. And a week later, after proper treatment, he was better. And a week after that, he was given away to a white family because they'd seen an ad in the paper offering Aboriginal babies. And this family from middle suburban Adelaide saw this ad and went along to the hospital, and the mother had always wanted a second daughter. And so they saw this line of Aboriginal babies, and they saw a curly-headed little girl, and they said, we'll have her. And so she was given to them, and they took her home, and when they changed her nappy at home, they discovered she was a boy. That's how Bruce was given away. That's how careless it was in January of 1958 in this country. When the mother at One Mile Camp Meningi, a little collection of humpies made out of flattened out oil drums and bits of sacking, when the mother managed to find a piece of paper and an envelope and a stamp and a pen, she wrote a letter to the department, and the letter still survives in their records. And she said, how's my Bruce going and when's he coming home? And they wrote back saying, he's doing quite well, but the doctors say he's not well enough to come home yet. They'd already given him away. And they didn't even go and look to see whether he was well for the next few years. And when he was 2.5 years old, he was admitted to the hospital again because he was pulling his own hair out, which anyone who's raised a child would know is a sign of real distress. Bruce was stolen from his family at the time of that correspondence. At the time he was taken, given away, there was an advice from the Crown Solicitor of South Australia telling the department in simple terms they did not have legal power to take Aboriginal children from their parents. And yet they did it. And their own correspondence shows they did it whenever the opportunity arose. Well, Bruce is the only Aboriginal person in Australian history who's actually persuaded a court that he was stolen, taken unlawfully, and suffered as a consequence, and he was awarded $800,000 damage, and a good thing too. Unfortunately, it was not followed by any suggestion that any government would offer a general compensation scheme. But this was the 1st of August 2007, and on the later that year, of course, Rudd came into office as Prime Minister. And on the first day of the new parliament, he said that he would say sorry to the stolen generations. And guess who they forgot to invite? Bruce Trevorrow. He was not invited because they overlooked him. Our capacity for forgetting is spectacular. And I rather suspect that in place of memory, we have instead installed our own imagined national myths, which are forged out of some kind of vanity in order to fill the void where real memories are and where our real character is to be found. And unless we start remembering soon, we may never actually be the people that we think we are. Thank you.
Well, we can hardly do better than that, but Nick is a brilliant speaker and got a wonderful way with words. He's a writer, and so I'll hand it over to you, Nick, and then we'll go on to John.
Yeah, thanks, Jean. I want to take up the question of how art and activism might actually work, and I suppose how it might help the kind of remembering that Julian's been talking about, and this wonderful work by Din, Erasure, is a powerful example. I don't know how many of you have actually gone through it and picked up a photograph and taken it to the scanner to go on the archive. For me, the way art and activism works is that there's a transfer of creative energy from the art to us as we experience it, and then that empowers us to take it out into the world and do something. And for me, that moment happens in Din's work when you're going through the piece, you're walking on that little bridge, you're taking in the sensations all around you, you're holding your normal upright posture, walking ahead as directed, and then you are invited to pause, to bend down, to stoop, to reach out and pick up one of those photographs. So you're taken outside your comfort zone as a gallery-going person, and you're invited to do something. And what you do is you pick up one of those photographs and you turn it around and you see a face. You see a person, maybe with a name, maybe with a date on which that photograph was taken, and you take that person over to the scanner and put it in the archive. In a very small way, you are performing an act of recovery of something that has been lost or obliterated through the upheaval and trauma of war and dislocation. But you have become, in a small way, an activist, an agent of something, an actor in a bigger history that connects you with that person in the photograph and all that happened. We engage through art of this kind, and that engagement is powerful and important. I actually did it twice. The first time I picked up a photograph, it was a young man who was photographed against a black silhouette of a head. So it was a kind of eerie double image of a shadow over this person. And then I did it again, and it was a small girl. It was a very faded colour photograph, and she had around her these large artificial flowers that were bigger than she was. And there's a tremendous pathos, of course, when you look at these randomly surfacing images to think, well, what happened to those people? And you can't help a kind of hope that, you know, dares not hope, that they might still be alive somewhere or that they might be recognised in that archive. So it's a very subtle and powerful model for me of the encounter between art and action. And rethinking things that happens through this work. I see art and activism as a crossing of a threshold, really, and Din's work crosses many thresholds between art and life, between his private experience and the public domain, between Vietnam's history and ours, and as Julian has been talking about, between that past in Australia when Vietnamese boat people came to Australia in great numbers and became part of the Australian community, and today when a refugee boat wrecked on Christmas Island last Christmas with that terrible loss of life reveals the barriers that have grown up between today's Australians, us, and other people. And there are other thresholds in the work to do with the Vietnamese community in Australia too, and Din as a diasporic Vietnamese from outside, from the United States and now back in Vietnam, and artists here who are sort of referenced by that, the video work by Nachu that accompanies the exhibition. What's powerful is the way the work connects with us, not just in our bodies when we do that thing with the photograph, but with our minds, as that boat reminds us of other boats, the Civex, Tampa, the burnt Indonesian fishing boats, the Dunbar wrecked at Sydney, Turner's burning Temeraire in that famous painting, Captain Cook's Endeavour. And the catalogue is great in actually explaining some of these references. And this enfolds us into the larger story and implicates us in it as well. As art, it's not didactic, but it doesn't let us off the hook. And that's a very powerful kind of art and activism. Ai Weiwei's kind of art can also do that. In May this year at Harvard, I saw his work Untitled, which commemorates the children killed in the Sichuan earthquake in 2008. You saw a bit of reference to that in that clip. This is a site-specific work of 5,335 identical school backpacks made into walls, which represent the exact number of children killed during the earthquake and in the subsequent collapse of poorly constructed school buildings. It makes a very eloquent point. But it's also making a point about the need to make the point in the face of the official cover-up of the kind that are endemic in the Chinese system. So Ai Weiwei, as an activist, is not just making the specific point about the children who were killed. He's making a bigger point about the need for that kind of openness, asserting the artist's right and duty to act as the conscience of society and to demand that free space in which to do so. His art is witty and provocative often. It's a way of testing the limits, and he found out where those limits were. But as an artist, he's in the vanguard, always pushing pushing at that wall to find the points where it might give and the points where it won't budge. And it's nice to think that he's doing that on behalf of other people in China who do not have the possibility of doing it in that way. As a visual artist, he has some scope to be oblique, ironic, non-specific in ways that can evade the literal-minded senses. For writers, who are the people I've had quite a bit to do with, it's not so easy. And we shouldn't forget Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Peace Prize winner last year, who remains in prison in China today for laying out a blueprint for peaceful political reform that many people signed on to. When he was in court, Liu Xiaobo said, "I hope to be the last victim of China's endless literary inquisition, and that after this, no one else will ever be jailed for their speech." He put himself out there with courage and clarity. He was the inaugural president of the Independent Chinese Pen, part of the World Association of Writers that supports freedom of expression. International Pen's Writers in Prison case list for 2009, the most recent one, records 900 attacks on writers, journalists, and publishers around the world for exercising their right to free expression. More than 40 of those are in China and Tibet, including many writers serving long prison sentences. Other writers have gone into exile. More recently, Liao Yiwu, who cannot publish his work in China, which is a terrible condition for a writer. A few years ago, Sydney Pen was the first pen centre in the world to extend its campaigns to writers in detention in our own country. We were moved to recognise that there were writers among the asylum seekers in Australian detention centres. Some were writers who had fled their home country to escape persecution for their work as intellectuals. Others were people who were called to write by what they experienced on their journey as refugees, joining the voices of so many others who have come to this country under conditions of dislocation and trauma. They too needed a space for their voices to be heard, and Sydney Penn produced an anthology of their work called Another Country, edited by Tom Keneally and Rosie Scott. Another country that was also this country. Artists, writers, intellectuals need asylum for the sake of their work as an integral part of who they are and what they can offer to others. They become activists in that sense. No example is more compelling than that of Indigenous artists and writers whose people became refugees in their own country, who have articulated a powerful sense of that country in their terms as a way of getting it back, body and soul. Think of Paddy Bedford's painting, Two Women Looking at the Bedford Downs Massacre Burning Place from 2002, for example, where just keeping that record in itself is a form of artist activism. As Alexis Wright, the author of Carpenteria, says, our books are time bombs. That exhibition I saw at Harvard with Ai Weiwei was called The Divine Comedy. And what was interesting is that it was organised by the Graduate School of Design, which is mainly about architecture, working with artists like Ai Weiwei, who have also worked with architecture, to explore what the curator, Sanford Quinter, calls the emerging domain of experimental spatial practice, where the concerns of art, design, and activism are powerfully converging. And in that convergence of artist, audience, and activism, of the kind I've been talking about, the space in which that happens, the space that enables that encounter to become active, is crucial. A space that allows the crossing from private to public and on into a lived personal response. A space of freedom, a space where thresholds can be crossed. This place, Sherman Contemporary Art Foundation, is such a space where erasure can connect with not only the community, but with other things we've experienced, such as Brooke Andrews' work, The Cell, which was here last year, or with the installation by Alfredo and Isabel Aquilizan called In Flight in Contemporary Art for Contemporary Kids, where kids recycled stuff to make planes to fly. And connect back to Ai Weiwei's work right here called Under Construction. When was that, Jean? A couple of years ago, the first show. Yeah. And even a reminder that this place was once a garage, a place of car kind of wrecking and construction as part of this community. So the Sherman Contemporary Art Foundation is generous and valuable in giving us that space for these connections. None of this would happen without that hope that I mentioned at the beginning, the hope that things can change, that things can get better. And I want to end with one short quote from Natalie Nguyen's fine book called Voyage of Hope, Vietnamese Australian Women's Narratives. She points out that for those Vietnamese refugees, that journey by sea is remarkable in that it constitutes an entirely new Vietnamese narrative. She writes, escape by sea was not only unprecedented in Vietnamese historical or cultural consciousness, it's become a defining narrative for the Vietnamese diaspora. The women that she interviewed had no means of knowing whether their attempt to flee their country would succeed or not. But she says their narratives, as they retold them to her, are always marked by two things that are inextricably linked: determination and hope. And she writes, although they all knew the risks and dangers involved, they were sustained by the hope that they and their family would survive the journey. Well, I would just add, if those refugee journeys were unprecedented for Vietnamese, they were also unprecedented for Australia, except that they've been repeated again and again, before and after. So what we need is that same hope now. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much. There's so many questions, I'm sure, that are brewing in people, or, you know, personal anecdotes to add, and I've got a special one which I'll add at the end, a very hopeful thing. So, John, on to you.
On to me. Can everybody hear okay? Put the microphone close enough. I think one of the things that I keep rubbing up against writing criticism in the newspapers and lots of other places is the constant sense of expectation one has that an exhibition that one sees and is that has a message, that has a meaning, that has a point, is also fundamentally got to be something that works on a number of different levels. I think that the current exhibition here, Dean Culay's work, is a very good show, a very good installation, so I'm not specifically addressing that. To me, that's something that does work on those levels. But I've seen lots and lots of things where the message, the idea, the meaning is a little better than propagandistic compared to what they're trying to get across. I'm not questioning the sincerity of artists so often. I'm questioning the means of execution. I think we live in an era of art, the contemporary art, where we're now starting to get back to issues of conscience. We're starting to get back to issues of meaning, that art has to be a meaningful activity. It can't be something which is simply there for the purpose of making you rich and famous. That is part of contemporary art, and that, I think, I'm afraid, will always be part of contemporary art. But if we look back to the very, very close past, remember people like the YBAs, the Damien Hirst, the Tracy Emmons, etc. They were doing sensational things. And why were they doing it? Because it was making them rich and famous. It was a kind of a class revenge. When Tracy Emin was out here last year and she spoke with Edmund at the art gallery, I was amazed that most of the conversation was about her big house in London, her house in France, the boat she was going to buy, how much money she made. And so, and then, but at the end, people were touched and moved and they said, Tracy, you're an inspiration to me. I thought, well, she's an inspiration of sorts, with no doubt about that.
Especially to artists with no money.
Exactly. I mean, if you wanted to put a political construction upon the YBA phenomenon, you'd have to say it's a form of class revenge. You'd have to say that a lot of these people were working class lads and lasses who thought it was the supreme irony that they would make crappy art and sell it for a huge amount of money to toffs and to rich businessmen and to people who went to all the schools that they didn't go to. Now, there's a fundamental difference in the role of artist and activist between what we have in our society and what we have in a place like China, which is, well, to all intents and purposes, a totalitarian society. Some say that Singapore is a totalitarian society. Whatever there is a central form of government which more or less tells you what to do, whenever your options as to what you can do and say are always going to put you at some kind of risk for your safety, I think this is where the difference lies. Ai Weiwei has been extraordinarily brave or extraordinarily foolish, depending on which way you look at it. A lot of the Chinese, I think, from my experience of talking to people in China about Ai Weiwei, it's almost a consensus that people feel like, why is he doing this? Why doesn't he just shut up? Why make trouble? Keep quiet. Don't do it. He's very silly. You know, he's asking for it. And would we be any different when people do things like that in Australia? We often say the same things. Why not just shut up? He's asking for trouble. Well, he asked for trouble and he got trouble. A lot of the things that Ai Weiwei have done as an artist, I think, would not be very remarkable when you put them in a Western context, like to go around Beijing with a camera and record all of the buildings that have been knocked, all the areas where buildings have been knocked down and the dreadful things have been put up, to record the streets of old Beijing as they're disappearing almost minute by minute. These things, it's not interesting art to watch, but it's valuable in terms of what he's actually saying, what he's doing. The gesture that he is making is 100 times more meaningful in China than it would ever be here. This fundamental difference between how artists can be activists in these societies and in our society, I think, is something we can never emphasise enough. In Australia, in the Western world in general, we're very happy to talk about something being revolutionary. We very easily sort of use that word revolution. But revolution, which is something that really got its great kick along during the Romantic era, was something that was meaningful for the Byrons and the Shelleys in terms of actually bettering people's lives, in terms of giving people fundamental freedoms. An artistic revolution is often merely a formal revolution. Artistic revolutions happen when somebody does something different to the edge of a canvas. An artistic revolution is when somebody digs a hole in the ground or goes for a walk and photographs it. These things have all been called revolutionary. Every time China is mentioned, Chinese art is mentioned in the newspaper, it's very glibly titled Cultural Revolution, or sometimes Great Leap Forward, which shows an absolute zero understanding of the enormity of what the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward actually stood for in China, and that these things were blood-soaked, you know, terrible, catastrophic moments in history. And then, of course, we had the Education Revolution. Now, that to me was a contradiction in terms. To have an education, this is where Julian talks about language. I think this is where the problems begin, when language is used in such a way that we can get a term like revolution, which is never done without bloodshed, and we can start to apply it to education, which is something which is fundamentally the opposite, which is the building blocks, which was often talked about as the key to everything, the key to our understanding, the key to how we're going to solve the problems with Aboriginal communities. It all comes down to education, but somehow we need a revolution to do it. Democracy, that Winston Churchill famously said, was the worst of political systems apart from all the rest, is now increasingly a hostage to the media and the opinion polls. That's not the case in China. In China, they are still making an extraordinary effort to control that media, to control the access and flow of information. And they're probably doing a better job of it than almost anybody. When I was in Iran a couple of years ago, I couldn't even get the Qantas website, or let alone the Sydney Morning Herald website. You could get the Canberra Times, by the way. but there was nothing to read. apart from something about the Canberra Raiders. But when I was in Iran, I found I couldn't get these very basic websites, and somebody who's with me is an Iranian, he just said, look, we've got a little patch. Doesn't matter, we can watch anything we like. And this is, of course, what happens when you censor the internet. Everybody has a patch within 2 minutes flat. They can do it in Iran. I think it's harder to do it in China. I think every time there's a patch, I think people come along and do something. They find a way of bringing a clamp down, of bringing down the roller door again. The way we understand China today, it's almost a crazy talk about it as a communist country. It's a communist country in name only. You can't really be a communist country with a stock market. Chairman Mao would have, you know, died and rolled over, had he thought there would be a stock market one day. And in fact, when Mao had this extraordinary comeback in popularity, he was coming back as the god of wealth. People were seeing he was going to bless their efforts in small-scale capitalism as some kind of great deity. What we have instead is we have a situation where the party, as one generation dies off and another generation comes along, is clinging to its power and its privilege. It is a cartel. It is something that has to be protected at all costs. And really, it's a question that you do not want to let those advantages, those things, go so easily. And if you have to invoke political and ideological barriers in order to do so, that's what will happen. And that is what is happening. Ai Weiwei came very close to being probably the first contemporary art martyr. I think he's come closer than anybody has ever come, and he may come closer still. He has pushed it so far, and he's been so outspoken and so blunt, and he has been protected by his high profile in the West, and we do tend to forget all those other people associated with him, all of those human rights activists, human rights lawyers, etc., who were not treated so kindly, many of whom are still in prison. And we can only admire his courage. Even if a lot of Chinese think that he's crazy, I think we have to admire his courage, because the kind of courage that he shows is not the kind of courage which is we are ever asked to show when we do an act of political art here, when we do an act of activist art. More often than not, when we have things in the West which we understand to be political or activist art, we're putting something in a white cube to preach to the converted. When I go to the MCA or some place like that, I might see a work of art telling me that racism is bad, or men don't treat women very well, or something else like that. But this is not a major insight. This is something that I understand, you know, as part of everyday life. You give it a tick and you move on. You actually want something that stops you and makes you think about things in a more nuanced way. You want something which has more than good intentions. You want something which is work which works on different levels. It has to have some kind of metaphor. It has to have some sense of taking you elsewhere. It has to make you stop and think again. I think that, you know, Dien Kyu Lei's work does that. What we get in this society is something that is so dominated by the ability to convey information to very large numbers of people that it's very hard for an individual artist or any individual to think about how they are going to go about doing something which actually has an effectiveness in terms of activism, in terms of political agitation. So the French philosopher Jacques Rancière has come up with this concept of dissensus, which he opposes, of course, to consensus. We live in the society of consensus. We live in societies where basically we're all supposed to agree on everything. Well, we were living in the society of consensus, and the Rancière idea that little acts of dissensus, little acts of dissension, little acts of rebellion, and little micro-political actions were going to have some kind of slow cumulative effect, I think has been thrown rather off kilter by what we've seen both in Australia and in America recently, where we have Tony Abbott practicing this sort of scorched earth policy of oppose everything at all costs, including his own policies occasionally, but quite by accident. Which is not a million miles away from the kind of mad troglodyte economics that have driven the faction of the Republican Party almost to bring America to its knees, to make a point, to make an ideological point. In fact, I think the real home of ideology today is not China, it's America. America is the greatest fundamentalist religious nation on earth. America is the nation of the greatest political ideological headaches. When you can bring the country so close, it shows that there is almost no sense of pragmatism at all. Whereas politics, what is politics? From time immemorial, politics has been the art of compromise. If we're talking about democracy, that worst of all political systems apart from the others, we're talking about a system where everybody has a say. When it gets to the stage where what everybody is saying is more or less contradicting what somebody else is saying, and he who says loudest and he who preaches most vociferously to those who are less likely to think about their responses, and that wins the day, we're in a very dangerous situation. This is the stage where the German jurist Carl Schmitt used to talk about the total state. the total state for him was the ultimate danger of democracy, that ultimately you would have a huge seminar where everybody babbled and things didn't get done, or we began to do things because we thought it might be a good idea, but because most people wanted to do it, it was popular. To act through popularity rather than policy was what Schmitt saw as the fundamental problem and drawback of democracy as it was emerging. Unfortunately, Schmitt's solution was to embrace the National Socialists, which meant that he was completely and utterly off the agenda of jurists and philosophers for about 50 years. But now they've rediscovered him, and they find that when you strip away the very, very bad political leanings at the end, he said a lot of very commonsensical things that are now coming to bear again. So what we have to do is to find ways around that particular consensus, around that particular sense of democracy being congested by these strident voices, by the politics of negativity which take on this extraordinary role. Can we say that it's going to change? Why not? It very well may. When things are taken to the very limits of negativity, they have a habit of bouncing back. I think what the possibility in America is that what we've seen with the Tea Party, what we've seen with the very, very extreme economics which don't want to pay any tax but want to, you know, cut every possible program, is you've put the country in a position where most people think this is nonsense. Most people can't believe that this is the political process, because it's not a political process. It's a process which is to do with some kind of pig-headed game of chicken. When I was interested what how we actually got to the stage where we're at today, where Julian and Nick are both talking about our incapacity to deal with common sense observations such as the number of people coming in boats is a tiny, tiny, tiny minority compared to the overstayers, that Malcolm Fraser could settle 20,000 boat people a year, but now we freak out, you know, if 300 Afghans turn up. And in fact, John Howard famously virtually won an election on that. I wondered to what extent we can look back on the Howard years and say that those were the years when we became less compassionate, more greedy. I'm not sure that we can blame it entirely on John Howard. I think it was in the air. I think it's a worldwide movement. I think that if art manages to do something in activist terms, it has to stimulate our capacity for empathy. It has to get us looking at something and asking questions. And sometimes the thing that can get us to ask a question is, why am I moved by that? Why am I struck by that? Why does this particular work speak to me in a way that maybe something else doesn't? It's not necessarily all about content. It's often about the way a work is put together. It's about a particular quality of thought. If you look at a lot of what's happened with contemporary Chinese art, you see similarities to work that was made under other totalitarian regimes, where artists found very oblique ways of making a point. Making a point which somehow escaped the censor, but nevertheless the point was there. The point was there to be read by those who would take the time and were in the know to know about it. And I think the visual arts, it's maybe harder in the visual arts than in other areas, because the visual arts is an area of licensed mayhem. It's an area where anything goes, where we can do anything, we've come to expect anything. Mike Park and Sew Up His Lips and Pee His Pants and everybody just ho-hum, we've seen it all before. They have these things over and over and over. But I talked to William Kentridge about what it was like to be an artist. And, you know, it's someone who was politically engaged in many ways with the theatre as well in South Africa during the apartheid era. And he said, to tell the truth, being an artist under apartheid made hardly any difference at all. He said there was very, very little overt repression of artists. He said artists could strike attitudes, say all the things they wanted to say, and very few of them ever got in trouble. He said it wasn't the case for writers. It wasn't the case for the theatre. It wasn't the case most definitely for film and television. He said, but somehow the visual arts managed to get by under the radar with very little interference, regardless of what they said and did. He said the only time he could remember an active censorship was when somebody was censored for a painting of the Last Supper that it put Santa Claus instead of Jesus Christ. They thought it was blasphemous. Now, I think that the question of how we overcome that great gap where art if the art that we're making, we want it to be meaningful, we want it to say something, we want it to touch people. That is that to me is a $65,000 question with all activist art. Where do we turn activist art into art that moves us, touches us, speaks to us, and how do we get that art across to a very large number of people? Because contemporary art, as we know, is pretty much a game for few players. The things that go out to a massive audience are often the most sensational things, or the things like Spencer Tunick's, you know, sort of naked people lying everywhere. That's always a guaranteed front page. I think we have this gap in the West, and particularly I think in Australia, between what we do in the world of art and what we think of in the sphere of politics. You see it in the way that funding is done in this country. You see it in the way that if somebody in a museum or a gallery misbehaves or does something terrible, it's not an issue, it's just the arts. Who cares? I mean, really, you could get away with almost anything in public institutions because these things are not treated seriously in the way that politics or business is put under the microscope. The arts are not put under the microscope, and when artists want to go out there and say something strident and be passionate and put forward a political program, it's often not taken very seriously. Artists no longer speak in terms of wider platforms. They don't speak as communists or leftists. They don't think of people who are trying to bring about fundamental revolutionary change in society. Everything that happens now and happens with a measure of success in terms of activist art is pitched at a grassroots level. It's done in terms of micropolitics. It's done at aiming for achievable goals and trying to further those goals. I wonder how many of those little goals do we have to put together before we make something, before we can move the mountain just a little bit.
Thank you. Guys, we've had, is this microphone on? No. Yes, we've had three very different addresses and from three very different perspectives. And I'm going to start with one little story, which is relates very closely to what Nick was saying about how our little act of bending down and lifting up a photograph and having it scanned by the archivist who's on duty, what a kind of ripples can result from that gesture. This is my story, and then I've got a question to everyone on the panel, and then I'll open it up to you. Story is as follows. Dean came up with the idea of the archive. And the archive is a very sort of peculiar archive because the images in the photographs are of people who are unknown. There are very few of the photographs that have got any annotation, occasionally a date, sometimes a name in Vietnamese, but almost no information sits on the back of those photographs. They were abandoned when the southern Vietnamese mostly fled Vietnam after the Americans retreated, and they just left everything behind, their homes, their goods, their furniture. They had to run. They knew they were facing two issues, two punishments, because they were seen to be collaborators of the Vietnamese. The one was they would be shot. Certainly their houses would be taken from them and their businesses. And thirdly, and the most horrific of all for most of them, was that they would be sent to re-education camps and re-educated, with pianists having their hands chopped off and various other brutal practices. So these people just ran and left their photographs behind. Now, we put together this catalogue, which I hope many of you will buy and read. And Donna, our general manager here, her parents live in France, in Burgundy. And we send catalogues, about 120 to 200 catalogues from every show around the world, to various curators, museum directors, writers, critics, people like John. All sorts of people get these catalogues as complimentary catalogues, and then of course we sell some here, and if the show travels, we sell the catalogues in other places. The Cell, for example, has traveled to six venues. So Donna sent to her parents living in Burgundy two catalogues, one for themselves and one for their neighbour, who is a French woman who had grown up in Vietnam and had been airlifted out of Vietnam at the end of the war when the Americans left, and the French, of course, was quite a large community there. Americans and the French were airlifted out to safety. And I've been in a helicopter recently. We were told we could take 15 kilograms of luggage. They couldn't take much with them. This woman was the a very senior curator of archaeology at the Louvre Museum, and she had just retired, and she was going in a she got the catalogue from Donna's parents, said thank you very much, she barely looked at it, got on the train, I think to go to Paris, either for a meeting or for her farewell, opens the catalogue, and on page 45 finds herself. A 13-year-old child in a Catholic school in Vietnam. She remembers the various girls in the photograph. Not everybody, but most of them. She knows what has happened to some of them, and she hasn't seen a photograph of herself in Vietnam for, well, she's at retirement age now, so we can imagine. And I think that's, in a way, whenever I tell the story, it only happened 2 days ago, I get a slight chill, because it's such a long shot when you think about it. From a child in Vietnam, airlifted after the war, to a place that eventually, Paris and then Burgundy, via Dinculay, who's been in America as a boat person, come back to Vietnam, come onto Australia to make a work of art, and then a woman from Burgundy to Paris opens the catalogue and finds an image of her young self. You don't know. This activism, I know what John means, there's a lot of gratuitous art out there that tries to make a point, and you do feel, God, you know, this point could have been made in one short sentence. But I don't think, and John said it several times, and I'm happy to know he feels this way, that this isn't that kind of art. This integrates an aesthetic experience, a poetic experience, this is in my opinion, a conceptual experience and an emotional experience. And it seamlessly seems to fit all those elements together. And it also has the opportunity, and this is what we were hoping for, it sort of part happened but hasn't fully happened. We hoped that some of those lost people on the ground in those photographs, that somewhere, somehow, we might find a boat person who survived and who nobody knew had survived, or reunite two members of a family. It's a hard archive to access because we don't have names, so there can be no alphabetical index. We don't have dates, so there can be no chronological index. And, you know, we've just got a mass of images. By the way, you can also add your comment. When you put the image that Nick so beautifully described, that you pick up your little activism moment, onto the computer, you are recording something lost, something not remembered, and you can also add a comment, and many people have done. I want to ask one question now of the panel, and then afterwards we'll open the floor. And it relates to both Din and to Ai Weiwei. And the question is this. Din left Vietnam at age 10. He got to a Thai refugee camp. They say that at least 50%, if not more, of the boat people that left did not survive. They drowned in the ocean, or they were killed by Thai pirates, but they didn't survive one way or another. Din's family managed to get to Thailand, to a refugee camp, made their way to America, and he did his high school, and he went to art school in America, and then made his way back to Vietnam. However, he doesn't show his work in Vietnam at all. He can't, he won't, be stifled, that's his word, not mine. And there is a point in the catalogue where he says, I cannot be stifled, I cannot have my voice sort of curtailed or silenced or changed. I won't show here because I don't want to self-censor and I know others will censor me. Yet he continues to live there. And Margaret Throsby said to him in the conversation here, but Din, if you can't, your family's not in Vietnam. If you can't work, you can do your work, but if you can't show your work in Vietnam, what are you doing there? Why are you there? And his answer was very simple. He started a foundation called San Art, S-A-N Art, whereby he offers the kind of space that that Nick so generously said that we offer here, but much more difficult to offer in Vietnam. As John said, it's all very well to offer these spaces in Australia, but much more dangerous there, for artists to gather, for artists to show their work, not him, for a little library. I've been there with magazines, mostly a lot of visuals because mostly the people who come can't read English. And when Margaret said to him, your family's not there, you can't show your work there, why are you there? You know, you're doing San Art. And he said, San Art is my work. So he didn't, in his own mind, distinguish between the work that he does like this and does all over the world, and the work that he does to activate others, to encourage them, to nurture them, and to give them a safe space, a safe-ish space for engagement. The other question, so I want to ask the panel, each one of them, whether they feel it's valid to go back and be silenced. I mean, effectively, he can't talk there. Talk or show his work visually. And the other part of the question relates to Wei Wei, who, as we've all said and we all know, is effectively silenced. And that's what he said to me on the phone. I can't speak to my staff. I can't speak about political issues. I can only do my work. Well, then the question is, it's exile, and he's been offered a position in Berlin, a professorship, or silence at home. So what, if you are an artist, would it be better, Nick, I'm going to ask you first, or do you think it, I mean, Picasso stayed in Paris during the war, during the Nazi occupation of Paris. Some people saw that as a protest, and some people saw it as collaboration. What, you know, and who knows? But what is the question I'm sort of struggling to put it in a simple term. Would it be better, what is the role of the artist? To be silent and or to go out of their own, or exile, silence or exile?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question I think that doesn't have an easy or general answer. So much depends on particular conditions. In the case of Din, I was very moved, really, to hear him articulate that he makes art which he shows here and outside Vietnam. So he's an activist through his art where he can be. But at home in Vietnam, he refers to it as his home. He's really a community activist enabling others. And those are two sort of different sides of, two sides of a coin, but I think for him, it's part and parcel of what he is.
His father, by the way, I don't know how many of you know this, and I can't remember whether it was in the catalogue, but his father was a high school principal. I think that counts.
Yeah. In the case of China, it's the situation there is always changing. To leave, in some ways, risks kind of ruling yourself out, putting yourself out of touch, out of play with what's going on. And even if the cost of staying is high, you can still operate, and particularly when things change. I mean, Liu Xiaobo is a more powerful case of this than Ai Weiwei, because he's consistently stayed in China, and now he's in jail for 10 or 11 years. But he's a more powerful voice than any of the sort of dissidents who left China.
Yeah.
When it comes to thinking about people coming to Australia, this is also a really interesting question, because people generally are coming into a society where it's going to be very, very hard for them to operate as artists or writers. Different language, making a start from scratch, adapting. It's tough, and you wouldn't really wish that on anyone. But for those who do it and those who succeed and connect with Australian society, it's a remarkable gift to us that can come out of that.
I think
it's an interesting thing, silence or exile.
Let me say, I did do a bit of thinking about art and activism, but I was so taken by the idea of the installation that I wanted to talk about, about memory and forgetting and so on. I think, at the risk of sounding like a barrister, I think it depends on what you mean. because and that in turn raises the question of who is your audience. You see, I would say that neither Din nor Ai Weiwei is being silent. It may be that they are at home, but they are not choosing silence. It's just that they're speaking to a different audience, a much, much larger audience than they can command at home. It's true. But we've all spent the last couple of hours talking and thinking about the work next door.
That's true.
He's not silent. He's speaking very clearly to all of us. In addition, he clearly thinks that his work was silent. I can't speak about that, but he clearly thinks that that is a way of communicating something that matters. So, and I think also by expressing his love for his country by staying there in the circumstances and then speaking to the world like this, I think that's the very opposite of being silent. Ai Weiwei likewise, I mean, no one could say that he's being silent. He's stifled at home, sure, but a much, much larger audience than China hears what he says and understands it. And when the authorities do crack down on him from time to time, that's a message which is heard around the world. You know, I think his silence is incredibly effective. and this notion of who it is that's your audience and what they will understand is a very important point. When I was thinking about the art and activism theme, I immediately thought of, not surprisingly, Beethoven. Now, Beethoven did live in post-revolutionary times. Mm-hmm. At the time when Beethoven was at his peak, the French Revolution was a matter of living memory. Its echoes were still shaking the titled heads of Europe. And that was the context in which Beethoven wrote his Ninth Symphony, which in its own curious way was revolutionary because it had a fifth movement. And of course the fifth movement was choral. Now the choral movement, as everyone knows, is called Ode to Joy, An die Freude, a poem by Schiller. And there is a story, it's not necessarily reliable, but I choose to believe it's true, and I offer it to you in good faith. There is a story that when Schiller wrote An die Freude, it was because he was writing An die Freiheit, to freedom. Mm-hmm. Now, it was impossible. When Metternich was the chief censor in Vienna, you could not write a poem to freedom. And if you think about what the words of the poem say, it's way over the top if he's talking about happiness. You know, joy, sparkling, shining spark of God, daughter of Elysium. I mean, give me a break. I don't think Schiller was so much into hyperbole. So An die Freiheit, I think, is thoroughly plausible. Beethoven believed it was intended as An die Freiheit, and people who heard it understood it as An die Freiheit. And so, of course, it passed below the radar. The censors couldn't possibly censor a song about joy, but the audience understood it as a song about freedom. And after the French Revolution, that was a seriously subversive and dangerous thing to do. It's a matter of picking your audience. And the other who seriously impressed me, who had much more trouble than Ai Weiwei, was Shostakovich. Dmitri Shostakovich, of course, sailed very close to the wind a number of times with the Russians. He got into a bit of strife. I think it was over Lady Macbeth, was it?
Lady Macbeth of Mid-Sense.
Yeah, and so he then wrote a symphony and dedicated it as an apology to the Soviet state.
Actually, the Nose got into trouble before Lady Macbeth.
Yes. So, often in trouble, as you said. And he wrote a symphony as an act of apology to the Soviet state, and it was the Fifth Symphony,
which is characterised by a very long, slow movement at the end, which brought the audience to tears, and again was simply unnoticed by the censors. It brought the audience to tears because in its long, slow strains, the audience saw the gulags in the wastelands of Siberia. He spoke directly to his audience in a way that the authorities didn't see. And of course, his Opus 67, his wonderful second piano trio, dedicated to his friend, the architect Solotinsky. Solotinsky, who died in a concentration camp. The second movement of the trio is also very slow and rather haunting, and he intended it to represent, and it was understood as representing, the clouds of smoke from the crematoria drifting across the fields of Poland. Now, that's the way you can speak whilst remaining silent.
Yeah, thank you. John, do you want your opinion?
Okay.
Silence or exile?
Silence or exile?
Yeah, you said no silence.
I have to do a toss-up. No, obviously there is no simple answer to this. Yeah. We'll get that one out of the way straight away. And for not only is there not a simple answer, for every pro there's a con. I mean, is it preferable to stay in a country and be effectively silenced, or to find your work compromised on every count? I mean, somebody like Shostakovich produced still an extraordinary amount of music. I mean, to me, he's probably the great composer of the 20th century. But every piece of music had to be made more or less under a kind of the veil of a lie. He had to pretend it was doing one thing when in fact it was doing something else. Now we can listen to his symphonies and think it's about the gulags and about Stalin's brutality. But at the time it was all about the suffering of the Russian people against the foreign invader and so on and so forth. We can understand that what he was doing gave birth to a lot of extraordinary personal pain, which is in the string quartets and in the last little sonata, which is one of the most painful, emotionally painful things one could ever listen to. And when Isaiah Berlin wrote about meeting Shostakovich when they brought him to Oxford to give him an honorary degree, and he arrived with a couple of big burly minders from the Soviet embassy, he was a completely battered, broken human being. He was just like even though he was still pouring out extraordinary music, he was, his personality had shrunk and shriveled to the state where he was fearful of everything. Now, Shostakovich paid an enormous price, emotionally and personally, for staying on in Russia and doing what he did. Not that he was also, from time to time, co-opted to be somebody like that in America. He was supposedly there as a statement of the Soviet people and so on and so forth. The hardest thing about living under these regimes, totalitarian regimes, we think of somebody like Miklós Horáci, who wrote a little book called The Velvet Prison about the arts in communist Hungary. And he said that it's a myth that people in totalitarian countries are oppressed and that there are these dissidents desperately trying to do things. He says what happens is more an incentive basis. He says that the writers who write the right things by the regime, who write in praise of the regime and who write positive, uplifting things and so on, are treated very, very well. They get the good apartments, they get the positions in the writers' club, they get the overseas trips and the lurks and perks. And in many ways, those things are more effective incentives for them to do the right kind of thing.
They do work here as well.
They did. Well, I once gave a talk at the Adelaide Arts Festival on that theme, and they'd moved me off two previous forums, and I was on one called Art in Eastern Europe, where I wanted to draw that parallel. Anyway, but what does one do if one is an artist who can't show his work, his or her work? Do you sit in impotent existentialist rage at home? But you don't have to be in a communist country to have the impotent existentialist rage. Every artist knows what that's like. It's called artist block. But when you're actually blocked by the state, that you, not only maybe you can't do these things, but you certainly can't show these things. I think there's a great deal of sense in thinking about going elsewhere and trying to do it elsewhere, even when sometimes an artist is cut off from his or her country, from his or her roots, they're not the same. Somebody like Tarkovsky, who made seven fantastic films, I think towards the end, the last film, The Sacrifice, which everybody thinks is so wonderful, to me is a much lesser film than the films that were made in Russia under very strange circumstances. Yet, had Tarkovsky worked under a different system, we would have 20, 30 Tarkovsky films today rather than a mere seven. It's one of those things where you have to trade off the intensity of the experience and the problematic nature of the art which is made, that everything which is given is taken at the same time. I think Nick had a very valid point when he talked about how hard it is for artists to come from a place like China and to make their way in a place like Australia, where not only do you have to learn the language, you have to learn the mores, the manners, the whole way the place works. You have to find out what people expect from artists, what kind of exhibitions are important. And it took everybody who came out here about a decade to really get the hang of it. In that time, they were working, like Guojian worked in a brick factory, Arshan drove taxis, Jia Wei used to paint their little drawings at the Darling Harbour. They did all of these rather menial jobs. And these things are, I think, character-forming, let's face it. But they worked and worked till they got to the point where they felt like they knew what was going on and they knew how to do it. And when they emerge after about a decade, they start to make extraordinary inroads into Australian art. And as a result, I think they have changed the whole nature of Australian contemporary art. I think that the Chinese art now is like an important new strand of contemporary Australian art after, say, Indigenous art. And in many ways, it's coming in a wave after the wave of Indigenous art, which we suddenly began to take very seriously in the 80s and 90s. Now, I think we're taking Chinese art with a measure of the same seriousness, and we're seeing it as important because it's international currency in terms of the value of the art, but it's also something that makes us a much more cosmopolitan place and connects us to the kind of things that people around the world are looking at. So I think that the country in which the disaffected exiled artist goes to actually stands to gain a lot from having those disaffected exiled artists in their midst. On the other hand, if you stay in the country itself and you can do something of genuine value, well, you've done something very noble and you've done something that we can all admire. And I think everybody has to make their own accommodations with their conscience, their own accommodations with their work as to how it works or doesn't work. Think of all the artists who came out here from China. Somebody like Shen Xiaomin. Xiaomin was out here for 10 years. We very rarely saw anything that Xiaomin did. Suddenly, the coast is clear. He can go back to China, and he's one of the boom artists in China. Suddenly, he's a massive superstar. It was as though he was sort of saving it all up till he could actually go back. But he only really fired. He only started to get it all together as an artist once he went back to China. And some people need to be, you know, touching their native soil to bring out the best. Some people, I think, probably need the opposite. Some people see it's a great relief to be away from that society where they don't feel like they're constantly being monitored and pressured, but they can go out on a limb and do something and make a statement that actually says something powerful about their home country that they're not able to make in their country itself.
It's a personal thing.
May I make the comment on the way past that clearly none of us would choose exile. Well, all of us would choose exile because none of us have chosen silence.
No, we've got some questions. So, Linda, are you here right now? Thank you. It's quarter to eight. What do you reckon? We've got 15 minutes or so. No? Okay, let's get as many questions in as we can. We won't have all the people answering every question.
Well, actually, I just want to make a slight clarification. Ai Weiwei has not been silent. A couple of days ago, he gave a very big interview. The thing about we are speaking from our perspective. If you read Chinese, you've got his interview. Now that was published in Hong Kong and on the internet, but it would be filtering back to China. And in that interview, he actually made a statement. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to. He said, and I'm just translating as I go, so it's not polished, but I am not going, because he was asked by the reporter, will you be trying to leave China now?
And he's,
would you be leaving? Would you want to leave? Well, would you leave? Yes, now. And he said, I'm not going to go. I don't want to go anywhere. So long as I am not, they do not threaten me or my family's lives or safety, I won't leave. When I was inside prison, I was thinking, you can do this to me, but because I don't have a foreign passport. Is that right? But now all my wounds heal, I forget the pain. People have the ability to recover. As soon as I was out from prison, I didn't want to leave China. I want to stay here and see what changes happen. So that's just a couple of days ago. And just one quick point is that in China, one of the very important things about whether or not you choose exile is that within China, the second you choose exile, the Chinese people write you off. Absolutely. So you lose all relevance and you lose your ability to speak to people in China. So the entire democracy movement overseas has no currency in China. Liu Xiaobo, one of the worst things that could possibly happen to Liu Xiaobo would be for the Americans to work out that deal that everybody said they've been trying to do, where he gets taken from prison into exile. He would be out of the loop completely. Okay. Sorry, it wasn't a question. I'm sorry, I know that's...
There's one at the back there, right at the back.
Just following on perhaps from what Linda said and connecting up also to Julian is I do think, and I'm going to take the case of us in Australia where I think there's a lot of us who might like to leave at the moment the way this country's going. And it wasn't long ago when most people in the arts had to leave Australia. And of course the whole respect for the arts and the whole place of the arts, as you know, it isn't allowed to have political relevance. It's not allowed, you know, the media doesn't help it in any way at all to show where it becomes relevant. And unless plays and writings are very specific, you know, our public doesn't get it. There's you know, they live with shock jocks and our politicians are exactly that. So what I want to sort of, I thought Julian's point about our incredible erasure of memory here and the entire way we've lived here, our entire history here has been about that. And we're not a reflective, contemplative people because it's constantly being erased. It's always to the new, to the fastest, to the new. Is it a colonial country mentality that just keeps on having to be like the new and the brave and the fast? I think that the idea of people staying in their own place in order to see the undercurrents, in order to feel them, in order to work with them, I think, as Linda was saying, is very important. Because when you're away, you don't see those things as they happen. You become removed, you hear about it in a different way. And I think that it's, of course, it's, if I think you can understand why so many artists do need to stay in the places they come from, because it is the source of their work, because most artists of all forms are always dealing with the history, always. And I think that it's just, it's that deeper connection you need to have, and however exciting and wonderful it is, in people in all art forms going and working away, they seem to need to return to the source of it. And I think that, it's a very important thing, I think, to do that. But also, as we all become more kind of international and global and the language becomes more global, I think the things that people are talking about often get picked up in other places internationally. I mean, you could think of a lot of issues, Aboriginal issues, that are much more, there's much more concern about them internationally than here. You know, a lot of politically, so many of the issues here that aren't allowed to be seriously dealt with, a lot of those things we've erased in our history are much more disturbing to others because they can see it. And they haven't erased all their histories. They live with their history. And I think the important thing for artists is to bring back that memory in a way. And I think it's a really, really vital thing to do, but I think it's sad that we just don't have this population, this media, to try and help the arts to do to recognise that's what they're doing.
For those people who don't know, that's Janet Lawrence, who is an artist and works with Loss and Memory a lot of the time. Jenny, I think we've got someone there. Who's trying to ask a question over there. But, you know, this is an artist speaking, and it's wonderful to have the voice of an artist, and especially someone who works with loss.
I hope, Janet, you won't be disappearing straight away, because I'd like to have a chat with you over a glass of wine about exactly what you've been saying.
Yeah. Hi, I didn't really have a question, but I just wanted to share that with regards to Ding exhibiting or not exhibiting his work in Vietnam. I was there at San Art for an opening last year, and he did have a piece of work in this group show. It was a bicycle construction with about, I don't know, 10 or 15 flags on it. And he explained to me that that was his comment on nationalism in Vietnam. And I was really interested at that talk in him saying about how he really felt that he couldn't make any comment about what was happening in Vietnam until he'd lived there at least 3 to 5 years, I think it was, before he could really understand what was happening in the society. And I guess in that way, he understands that a work like Erasure just would not
be possible. It,
yeah, partly because, I mean, if he loves his country, it's kind of like, it wouldn't be productive. It's not time yet. So small steps, I guess.
Can I add a comment, which is not plausibly connected with what you've said, but it did occur to me that probably one of the most useful areas of activism in art at the moment is graffiti, street art. Mm. Now, some of it's rubbish, obviously. A lot of it's rubbish. But there's some pretty good graffiti around. And graffiti is good because, first of all, it really pisses people off. So you've got their attention. You've got their attention right away, even if they're people who never walk into a gallery. So the audience sees it. And if it's skillfully done, it can actually make you... You'll walk away and you'll be pissed off that someone's done that, but you won't lose the message that's being conveyed. And I think that's fantastic.
Unfortunately, most of the time, the message is just somebody's tag.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. I said a lot of it's rubbish.
It's a message of American imperialism.
Yeah.
But at the National Gallery in Canberra, for what it's worth, is collecting graffiti art. Now, how you do it, I don't know.
Well, there's big concrete walls.
Yeah, thanks for some very interesting views. I'd like the panel's views on... thoughts about the real utility or the real effectiveness of art in bringing about any form of social change. And it's also in the context of what Julian just said about graffiti art. I think one of the more memorable pieces of graffiti art in the last few years has been the No War graffiti across the Opera House, which is possibly not art, but certainly is graffiti. And so I'm just wondering if you'd comment on the very small elite audience, really, that art addresses once it's put into the institution, vis-a-vis visual art or visual statements out in the wider world, be they graffiti art like No War, or be they documentary photos appearing on the front page of a newspaper and the impact they have on changing policy. Thanks. Julian, actually.
Can I pick up 2 points?
Yeah.
I'll be very quick. It can be gravel in the shoes of the society, and that in itself is useful. I mean, aiming just at the elites who go to upmarket galleries is probably not enough. But a couple of things occur to me. The Beethoven story. In Christmas 1989, Leonard Bernstein conducted a performance of Beethoven's Ninth in Berlin after the wall had come down, and they sang "An die Freiheit." Yeah. Okay, so that's pretty good. And in February or March of 2003, when Colin Powell announced that America was going to invade Iraq, he did it in one of the big public spaces in the UN building in New York. On the wall behind him was a mosaic representation of Picasso's Guernica.
Which you understand they covered
and,
up.
And they had covered it up.
Yeah.
They covered it up. That's the idea of gravel in the shoe. And someone commented in the Times the next morning, the New York Times the next morning, that they could hardly persuade people that it was a noble idea to invade Iraq when the announcement was made against a backdrop of screaming and mutilated women, children and horses. Mm. Now, you know, that's art that is speaking 70, nearly 80 years later, sufficiently loudly that they have to airbrush it out of the picture. I think that's, you know, never give up on the possibility.
Nick would like to answer, even though. Nick, did you want to...
Well, the poet Auden famously said, poetry makes nothing happen, which is the line for those who think that art doesn't do anything. But I don't think he quite believed that, and I think none of us really want to believe that art is completely kind of useless and frivolous. The question then is how to say what it does. And this really goes to Janet's comment, I think. I mean, Janet, I think of as one of our great activist artists. I mean, the work that Janet, you did with Fiona Foley at the old government house site, what's it called, Line of Trees? Edge of Trees. Many of you will have experienced that. Countless tourists have experienced that. So we can't measure what effect that's had, but I think we can safely say it's had an effect. And the fact that the media or the arts administrators may not be able to kind of bean count the effects of art doesn't mean that art makes nothing happen, in my view.
Especially because they can't.
Yeah.
Well, they don't lock up artists like Solzhenitsyn if it doesn't count. I mean, obviously...
Somehow it counts more when they lock them up.
Well, can I just follow through on the remark about Auden, and perhaps it's appropriate given what we've seen?
Yes.
He once wrote a very short poem which said, "Acts of injustice done between the setting and the rising sun in history lie like bones, each one." Mm. Yeah. That's the sort of thing that'll stay with you and move you around.
Maybe you should finish on that.
That's a good one.